India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and at this time we begin the TechNet K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear KC2 WGB, John, who handles the mailbag. You'll hear Paul, WS2N, who gives us the latest space report. From time to time, you'll be hearing from Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of experience with a lot of ham radio equipment. You'll also hear people like NY2H and quite a few other people from time to time. The main purpose of the TechNet, you guys have heard it many times before, is education. The curious ham radio operators who want to know more about how wireless equipment works and how to make it work better, they gather here, they ask their questions, listen to other people's questions. Quite often somebody hears a certain subject of discussion and says, hey, I've got some experience in that area. And he chimes in and gives us the benefit of that experience. So it's a gathering of people who want to know something more about radio. And it's an awful lot to learn about radio equipment. The books do a medium good job of explaining it. You've got a whole lot of books. The electrical engineering courses do a less than medium job, in my opinion. They can do a hell of a lot better in teaching information in useful engineering form. They teach in an extremely traditional manner, which is no longer up to date, in my opinion. So if you want a good radio operator, a good radio engineer, most likely you have to hire a ham radio operator. Oh, I see this connector is loose. My microphone was almost unplugging. Okay, let me drop. A person who does have a question or a comment for the net signs in and gives us his call letters. Name. You gotta give me the name because I'm awful forgetful. I like addressing people by name. That's just me. Followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just to say that you're listening. By now, after 32 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. This net began in September of 1982, 32 and a fraction years ago. And by way of IRLP and internet, and then Echolink, it links to a number of repeaters in a number of states and a number of countries. And occasionally we get sign-ins from people in other states and other countries, particularly Canada, for instance. Let me drop. And we do have John, KC2WGB, who monitors the website for Echolink. So therefore, if we're a little bit too quick on the trigger and we don't give you enough time to sign in, John will know about it. And you can also give John KC2WG messages by way of Echolink, letting him know that you're having trouble signing in or that you want to have a particular question asked. John also handles the mailbag, which means people who don't yet have the ham license or don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly, they send him a message by any one of a number of manners, and he selects two, three, or four of those because they have general interest and we discuss them. So you're about to give me your check-ins at this time. A typical check-in would sound like this. WA28PG, WA2PJF, I should say. WA2PJF, veto and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
2E out, Dick, with a question and a comment.
KD2A2C, Steve, and yes.
Okay, so far we've got Rich and Steve who signed in just right. Call letters, name, and the word yes. Anyone else to sign in with the a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters and name right now.
NQAIR, Greg in Masters, Queens with a question.
Okay, we got you, Greg, from Masters, into AIR. Call letters like that, you should be a pilot. Okay. As I said, we've got Rich, Steve, and Greg. Anyone else to sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now.
Introduction. I wonder, did you have a chance to go over your email?
Yes, I did. And what he's referring to right now is the Eiffelsberg 300 It's a 100-meter, 330-foot diameter dish, and the beautiful low-noise front end on L-band they've got on that. So it looks like Wes is going to want to discuss that a little bit more. Good subject for the later discussion. Okay, Rich, we know that you've returned, and your house is now in pretty good shape. And so the ham radio equipment, I guess, pretty good shape, but it's about to change a little bit. And 2EO, the voice of Massapequa on ham radio, K2LAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, very good. And 2EO, yes, I'm back. Complaint to the hospital. I just say I had a mishap. Nobody's fault, but an artery opened up in my foot about a week after the surgery. I literally almost bit the dust, bled to death. Last thing I remember is passing out in a chair. I woke up in the bed, and I was told that a whole people, and a lot of people in the room, they called it code blue or rapid response, and stopped breathing. I turned blue and my heart stopped, thanks to a doctor, Juan Baez. He performed life. So that's a nice thing. Patricia came up and she was very worried about me. Anyway, I think I have a question. I have, you're coming back, an ATO Barry has it right now, was struck by lightning. The watt meter is a crispy critter. Better 6 inches from Mary's rock.
Metal in the middle of the dipole. I'll turn it over to Hal first. K60PZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
Very good. Okay, first of all, let's look at the ground plane as being as a half-wave folder, a dipole. The only difference is a dipole basically is 72 ohms approximately. A ground plane is made to be 50 ohms. So if you take a dipole and you start bending its elements closer together, you're going to get number one closer to 50 ohms. If you put other counterpoise elements on there, it gives you an equal omnidirectional radiation of that driven element. So basically, you could say a ground plane is a dipole on a vertical polarization, and you have the radials, which are bringing the impedance down and also giving you a constant omnidirectional radiation factor. That's my fast, quickie answer. Now I want to hear the professor. It's K6DPZ.
About bending the radials down to increase the impedance.
You can do that too until you get to 72.5 ohms, but 50 ohms is standard. When you bend them down, you're basically creating a coaxial type of antenna. So go ahead and pick it up. That's my quickie answer.
Yeah, I'm going to start one step back from where Hal did. We all know a dipole is one of the most basic, extremely universal antennas, and it's inside of many other kinds of antennas, like Yagi's. Half of a dipole is inside of a waveguide, a coax adapter, and so on. A large number of antennas. The basic beginning of the process is a dipole. A dipole in free space, at one instant of time, you're putting positive voltage on the right side, negative voltage on the left side. On the next half cycle, you reverse that process. There is a neutral plane down the center of the dipole. You could put a sheet of metal at right angles to the wire, right down the center of a dipole, with a hole for the wire to go through. And it would make absolutely no change in the impedance, the pattern, or whatever, because you put it at the neutral plane. Once you've got that infinite sheet of metal I just described, and the right-hand side of the dipole, you can decide to feed just that alone and throw away the left-hand side. The dipole itself has got around 72 ohms of resistive impedance, if it's the right resonant length. That would give you no reactance, just 72 ohms of apparent resistance. And when you cut it in half by putting that sheet of metal there and only feeding the right-hand side, it is a 36 ohm antenna, half the impedance. That's if it's a flat sheet of metal going to infinity. When we now just take that dipole with flat sheet of metal I just described, rotate it 90 degrees so that the half of the dipole is now sticking straight up, and that's our ground plane antenna. Put a large number of radiators there, and you are feeding a 32 ohm antenna. Large number of radiators trying to act like that infinite sheet of metal. In the case of a VHF antenna, let me drop. You don't have to put very many radials. Three radials is usually more than enough for a VHF antenna high up off the ground. On the ground, you need a whole lot of wires out there to make sure that you're not feeding RF energy into the earth, which is a lossy material. And although you might have a good standing wave ratio of that antenna, you still don't know how much of the RF energy is heating the soil as opposed to being radiated to space if you don't have enough ground plane radials. And a really serious person will put down 32 of those radios just to make sure that the impedance to ground is a small fraction of 32 ohms, like 3.2 ohms, if you know what I mean. In the case of a VHF dipole up in the air, three radials is usually more than enough. You do slant them down. As you slant them down more and more, the impedance goes up. At some particular slanting angle, probably somewhere around 45 degrees, you hit 50 ohms at the base. If you slid those three radials all the way down, you've now created a pure vertical dipole, and you'd be back to 72 ohms. So you've got a certain amount of adjustment like that. Because the VHF antenna is usually quite far above the ground, you don't have to worry about the energy of the radiators, of the radioles heating up the soil, because you're far above the soil. So there's quite a significant difference in the philosophy and method of operation of a VHF antenna, a number of wavelengths above the ground, as opposed to a pure HF antenna, vertical ground plane, right on the ground. That's some of the information. You're allowed to ask more questions on what you've heard so far, Steve. KD2HUC, the ham radio voice of COMAC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
W8YY, Joe, what question on this subject?
You're on the list, not to worry, Joe. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, Dick, so my first question is, the bending down of the radials is strictly to match impedance. nothing to do with the radiating pattern. Is that a true statement?
In my opinion, Steve, that is a 95% true statement. As you bring those radials down to the flat parallel with the horizon, where you would have roughly a 36 ohm antenna, and you start slanting them downward, the impedance increases. If you slanted them all the way down so that they're purely vertical, and that would be a pure vertical dipole, you'd be up to 72 ohms. So primarily, it's done for resistive impedance matching. Your real question now is, does the pattern change? And the answer is yes, but it's an extremely minor change. If you now plotted the elevation pattern versus the tilt of those angles, you would see extremely little difference. But part of what's going on here is that the antenna is pushing electrons. Make believe, just to give you an example of the physics involved, let me drop. Let's assume that Arnold Schwarzenegger weighs 200 pounds. He's floating in the cargo bay of the space shuttle while it's in orbit. He's in weightlessness. In his hand is a 200-pound barbell, and he weighs 200 pounds. He pushes the barbell 1 meter per second to the north. By Newton's third law, action and reaction, he moves 1 meter per second to the south. He's pushing against something in that case, okay? Your transmission line is feeding energy into that antenna. At one instant in time, it's trying to push electrons into the radiator, and it's going to take them out of something. It's called a ground plane. And on the other half cycle, it's doing the opposite. It's pushing the electrons into the ground plane and taking them away from the radiator. As I said, that counterpoise is what the antenna pushes against. That's the main portion of what's going on with launching the signal onto the radiator and coupling your energy into the antenna and getting a good impedance match. And once again, the vertical radiation angle coming off the side of that radiator changes very slowly as you tilt those ground plane radials. And because the vertical beam width is around 88 degrees, 85 degrees, it's so darn broad. And if the peak of that beam moved 5 degrees because you've tilted the radial, you're spinning in the ocean, not very much is happening. I wonder if that makes a little more sense to Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the tech net.
DPC, could I get in 1 second, Dick?
Go ahead, Hal.
I'm taking a break for dinner. I'll be back in 45 minutes or so, and if I could give any answers after that, I'd be more than happy to. Roger?
Okay, we'll be standing by. You got it, Steve.
Okay, Dick, yeah, that does make a lot of sense. Now, that leads me to my next question. If the placement of the radials around the antenna helps, you know, create an equal, you know, omnidirectional radiation pattern, will the signal favor, you know, let's say that you only went, say, 180 degrees, if you're looking down from the top and you only had a radial, say, at the 3 o'clock position, will the radiation pattern favor the side with the ground plane or the opposite side of the ground plane? So does it act more like, does it draw the signal or does it reflect the signal? I guess is the question that I'm asking. If the question makes sense to you, Dick. Back to net.
Yes, it's a darn good question, Steve. The majority of the radiation takes place from the radiator. That's a pure vertical device in your particular case, and it's radiating broadside, and it's radiating, the radiator is radiating equally well all 360 degrees, 1 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and so on, 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock, the radiator. You are getting a minor amount of radiation from the ground plane radials, but it is nowhere near as much, partially because the current is being shared into 3, 4, or 5 radials, depending on your particular antenna design. They are sort of at a crazy angle compared to the vertical polarization. You're almost looking at them in view, if you know what I mean. So if you now took the total antenna with only radials on one half the cycle, in other words, you put radiators at, let's say, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and 6 o'clock, and you avoided the radiator at 9 o'clock, there would be a slight increase in amplitude of the signal toward 3 o'clock and a slight decrease in the signal toward 9 o'clock. But the difference would probably be half a dB. It would be hard to measure. the majority of the real radiation is the vertical radiator, and he's radiating broadside, if you know what I mean. So you could lose some sleep over this one, Steve, and it's not justified. I wouldn't worry about it. Do the best job you can of putting down those radioles, and if it's a true ground plane type antenna, in other words, an HF antenna really down at soil level, the more radials, the better, because you're trying not to couple RF energy into that resistive volumetric material called soil, dirt, if you know what I mean. Well, let me drop.
H2Wild.
Bernie recognized, if the antenna is in contact with the soil, the reason why in the limited case you put down as many as 32 radioles is because you're trying to create this infinite sheet of metal. You're trying to make the spacing between the radioles so small that very little of the RF energy gets a chance to sneak into that gap between the radioles and light up the soil. Because any RF energy that manages to get into the soil by sneaking between the radials is heating up the soil, wasting the energy that you would like to be radiated into space, and to make a measurement to confirm how much goes into the soil is a very difficult measurement. You can't tell with your standing wave ratio meter. It would be very difficult to ask somebody to look at their signal strength meter to try to confirm it. You'd have to do a really good experiment. You'd have to fly a helicopter around the antenna, 360 degrees, various altitudes, and take a whole lot of measurements to measure total radiated power. You can see how difficult that experiment would be. But in the most case, we're probably talking about a minor effect here. And if you happen to live above salty water, life is a lot better because salty water is such an extremely good conductor compared to normal dirt that that loss factor almost disappears. Now, I bet you Bernie has built a number of ground plane radial antennas in his time, and then let's see what his experience shows. Over to you.
Dick, quick point.
Okay, John Person, then pass it over to Bernie. You got it, John.
T2WGB. Yes, Dick, I'd just like to point out, if anybody has any questions tonight on DMR, being that we have one of the wizards, Bernie, with us, he knows just about anything you need to know. Also, I believe Eric is available for information, so just keep that in mind. Thank you. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Bernie.
Boy, I'm afraid to say anything after an introduction like that. Question is the original questioner. Are you looking for HF or VHF, UHF? The reason I bring that up is that in the ARRL has a more technical document. Dick will probably know the name of it. Not QST, but there are other ones. And a few years back, a gentleman out west did a very good study on how many radials were necessary. He was working in the HF range and did it fairly scientifically, but physically did it. Put one more radial, did they notice it? Two more radials, did they notice it, et cetera? Did an exhaustive study on this. You should be able to find that on the league's website. If you can't, drop me an email, and I may have copies of it.
There's several of those articles in PureX.
Yeah, what they're both referring to, Steve, is QEX, the Experimenters Exchange. This is this other monthly or bi-monthly journal of ARRL, which gets into technical subjects. And so by way of the ARRL archives, you will be able to find this article that Bernie is referring to. In fact, Bernie will eventually tell us what month and year this article, where the guy really did the physical experiment and the real measurements. And a darn good article. Appropriate for an HF antenna mounted flat to the ground. A VHF antenna high up on the tower with three little radials, as you can tell, is a different thing. And where you are asking about the tilting down of the radials, which is something you can do with a VHF antenna on a tower, and you don't have the resources to do that. Very few of us are going to hire a bulldozer and make a cone-shaped chunk of land in our backyard where we mount our ground plane antenna so we can tilt down those radials. As you can see what I'm saying there, Steve, to be a little bit ridiculous. KD2HUC, K2LIW, good set of questions, Steve.
using factory antennas, but, you know, last night I happened to be sitting outside, and I have my VHF antenna is mounted to my chimney, and it's right next to an old 11-meter antenna that I have on the chimney, and the ground planes are completely different, and, you know, I was curious as to why, so I started doing a little research, and there's about as many, you know, old wives' tales regarding counterpoise as there is, you know, the magic length of cable. So I wanted to, you know, get a clear, concise, you know, answer from you guys, which I got. So, yeah, that's two questions down that I now have a very good understanding of. So I appreciate it. And if I have any follow-ups, I'm always here. I'll ask them. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. KD2HUC, back to net.
And in passing, I'm going to give you one other piece of advice, Steve. The old wives' tales will lead you to believe that when you're mounting on, say, a chimney mount or the top of the tower, two, three, and four antennas all on the top, they'll give you ridiculous answers as to what spacing between the antenna is required so that they don't interfere with each other and degrade each other's performance. As long as the antennas are truly on different frequencies, like one antenna may be on 6 meters, and one's on 2 meters, and one's on 220, one's on 432, and one's on 1296. As long as the antennas are on different frequencies, the amount of spacing you have to have between the antennas becomes extremely small. Like in many cases, a foot or so is more than enough. And your first question is going to be, what happens if I exceed that, if I put them 6 inches apart, when they should be a foot and a half apart? And the answer is, the extra other piece of metal close by adds some capacitive effect, tuning the shorter antenna to a slightly lower frequency. And if you wanted to readjust the length accordingly, you could bring it back to resonance, and it wouldn't even know the other antenna is there. So as long as they're on different frequencies, the spacing required can be extremely ridiculously close. Another good example is, for instance, the Fenco 6 and 2 meter Yagi antenna. This was a popular antenna way back in the 60s and 70s of the last century. Here, you had one single boom, which had some elements on it for 6 meters and some elements on it for 2 meters on the same boom, with the elements, you know, interspersed between each other. A very successful design. And there you could say you got a 2-meter antenna and then a 6-meter antenna where the spacing between them was literally zero. A slight readjustment of the element length was required, a very successful design. So as long as you know what you're doing and the frequencies are different, you'd be amazed how close you can be.
Repeater, timeout.
PS with a comment.
Very fine. John's monitoring the Echo Link and the KTUPS probably mobile. I'm going to go over to Rich in a minute with his information on this, because from his mobile, he puts all kinds of antennas close together. You can find respected sounding articles on the internet where people will tell you the effective area of this 6-meter antenna is a 10-foot circle, and effective area of this 2-meter antenna is a 5-foot diameter circle. Therefore, 5 foot plus 10 feet, there must be 15 feet of spacing between the two antennas so they don't interfere with each other. Absolutely, positively not true. Good sounding common sense. And what happens is that when you operate on 6 meters, that 5 foot diameter effective area of the 2-meter antenna disappears. The frequency is wrong. It only has that effective capture area on its tuned frequency. So those effective capture areas that people have used so many times in these articles are pure hogwash. Good sounding common sense, dead wrong. The RF doesn't behave that way. So, Rich, you put lots of antennas close together. You've worked with ground planes. Guarantee you've got some opinions on all of this. And for the fun of it, please tell us what state you're in with your mobile vehicle. Here we go. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, mobile, most likely. K2 RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Hi, okay, Dick. K2UPS mobile in the net. I'm in West Virginia right now, just outside of Wheeling, and it is raining and 73 degrees, but other than that, not too bad. My comment on the HF ground plane is I'm operating currently at the house a Hustler 4-band, 40, 20, 15, and 10.
With a tuner, I can load it up on the other bands, but it's not, it doesn't have the actual parts to make it normally resonate there, but it's designed primarily for 4210 meters. And I only run four radials on it, roughly in an X pattern. I believe the radials are 30 feet long each. I made them all exactly the same, either 30, 33 feet, something like that. And it's set up roughly like an X. And I did that last winter, well, late last fall, when the landscaper wasn't coming through anymore. And I meant to get out there and pick up the radials before he came through, because they were just laying on the ground. And he got there before I could do that. And consequently, I only have two radials now. But I still make plenty of contacts, and I operate QRP. Now, I'm not saying that that's the only way to go. I'm sure if I put down 15, 20 radios, it would work even better. But I'm having a lot of fun working a lot of stations with originally just the four, and now even just two. So you don't have to go crazy with the radio. If the antenna is elevated and you can mount an H-shaped vertical on the roof or on a shed, and then your radios would be elevated, then you want to have tuned radios where you have at least one on each band that you want to work on, cut for roughly a quarter wavelength. If the antenna is ground mounted at HF, and the radio is either going to be lying on or buried slightly below the ground, then the length is not as critical. It still helps to get as much as you can in the ground and cover as much area around it as you can, but they don't have to be a specific length if they're going to be on the ground. Back to net.
Don, good information, and I thank you, Rich. And Rich is now telling us one more, he didn't realize it, but he's giving us one more examples of the philosophy of a ham radio operator. Don't lose a whole lot of sleep over it. Go ahead and do it. Even if the number of radios you put down are inadequate in size, inadequate with number, inadequate with the number of them on the individual bands of a multi-band antenna, the antenna is not going to catch on fire, it's not going to explode, it just gives you a little bit lower performance, and at some later time you can add more radials if you think the need is going to arise. If you've done a fairly poor job of an HF antenna in contact with the earth, you've got fairly resistant soil, you don't live right on the seashore where you've got the, you know, seawater 2 feet down below your land, which would be an extremely good ground plane. You might live on a much more sandy soil if you drop the roof. And if you did that helicopter test and you found out that half of all of your RF energy is heating up the earth because the RF energy is sneaking in between those ground plane radials and is heating up that volumetric resistant material called the dirt in your backyard and keeping the worms warm in the wintertime, if 50% of your power is going there in the worst case situation I could think of, boy, that sounds terrible. You're radiating 100 watts and only 50 watts is really getting into space. You're putting out 200 watts on the transmitter. In reality, that's only 3 dB down, half an S unit of a well-calibrated S meter on the other end. When Mother Nature opens up the band, when she does something really good with the ionosphere, and the signals are coming in 10 dB over S9 as opposed to S1, which is a difference of 90 decibels of difference, and you've got 3 decibels of difference because your antenna is running either 100% efficiency because you've got 32 radials on each of the bands, or at least on the lowest bands, as opposed to just 3 radials down, 3 dB is going to make, in the case of a pileup where you're not running high power and there's a zillion guys, yeah, that edge is going to hurt you, but the rest of the time, when you're not working somebody in a pileup in some exotic location, the half of an S unit is not to use a whole lot of sleep over. And as I said, it's not going to explode. Just go and do it, if you know what I mean, and experiment with it later on. And talk to your friends, even on the TechNet, and find out what you think is happening. And you're doing the right thing by asking the question. KD2, HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
So now that's on, that covers the HF. And as long as you're multiple wavelengths above the ground with the VHF, UHF, then it's completely negligible. Is that a true statement, Dick? KD2 HUC?
You're right on, Steve. When you're a good number of wavelengths above the ground with a VHF antenna, yes, the RF energy, you could say, could sneak in between between those ground plane radios. But there's nowhere it can go. It's in the air. It's already being radiated, you know what I mean? For that signal, the amount of signal that's scored straight down in that circumstance, when your antenna is, let me pick a number, 20 feet above the ground, and it can get all the way down to the earth and couple into the earth, very little of it. Don't worry about it. So when it comes to the ground plane radio criticality, it essentially almost all disappears when you're on a VHF antenna high above the earth. High above the earth, in my case, is like 10, 15, 20 feet. The guys with an antenna, let's say 160 meters or 80 meters in direct contact with the soil, they've got to work a little bit harder if they want high antenna efficiency. But even if you start off with a 50% efficient antenna, because you've got very few radials down on each one of those bands, that's not a showstopper. And for that matter, 50% efficiency on a 100-watt transmitter, which means 50 watts is being radiated. Talk to guys like Rich, the guy you just talked to, K2UPS, let me drop him, who does a whole lot of his operating in QRP, running 5 watts output. And even with a 50% or efficient antenna, you've got 50 watts of real radiated signal in the space. You'd be amazed how many guys on 5 watts work a whole lot of countries and states and so on. I was at a gathering of ham radio operators today in which one of the guys I was talking to made some contacts at 330 milliwatts with somebody, I think the person he talked to was like 50 miles away, 30 miles away. So RF energy goes everywhere, no matter what the power is. Only thing left to discuss is, are you using a sensitive enough receiver to receive that signal? And so the most extreme case, of course, is Voyager. It's out there 12 billion miles, a 6-watt transmitter at 8.5 gigahertz, where the signal one way takes 17 hours to get here at the speed of light. And boy, is that a QRP signal, and is that DX, 12 billion miles. And we listen to it, and it sends us down information, and it's been doing that now for 37 years. And it's going to be doing it to the year 2025 because of its nuclear power supply as it continues going out there at 35,000 miles an hour. That's QRP, and that's DX. Serious stuff. KE2HUC, K2LAW. Go ahead, Steve.
All right, Dick. So while we're on the subject then, I just want to ask one other question. I don't want to monopolize up all night. Is it a safe assumption then that the ground plane from one antenna, I mean, the radiating elements that are tuned to specific frequencies will not, there won't be any interplay between each other. What about the ground planes of adjacent antennas? For example, I'm in the process of relocating my antennas, but right now, my VHF antenna is actually below the point at which the ground plane radios from the 11 meter come up on an angle. Do you think there would be any reflection of signal, a change in pattern, having the ground plane come up alongside the radiating element of another antenna? Is there any interplay from adjacent ground planes? KD2HUC.
Probably 90% of the time, for various kinds of arrangements like you're describing, Steve, the answer is no, no interference. There's at least two ways of looking at this technically if you want to dig into it. One way is effective radar cross-section. In other words, when you're radiating with, let me say, a 6-meter antenna, and the radiator of the 6-meter antenna is real close to the ground plane radials of the 2-meter antenna that's stacked above it, and you would think, boy, that looks like they're going to really destroy each other. Well, the next question is, how big a radar-reflecting object is that 2-meter antenna and its ground plane radials when you're radiating on 6 meters? Because it's tuned to 2 meters and you're radiating on 6 meters, 95% of the time it's not there. As you start moving antennas close together, I've run a number of backyard experiments on this on my antenna range, which that so-called radiometry antenna range, which you can read about in, I think it was 1978, I think it was QST, I think it was the February issue, I'm not sure, but you do a search on my call letters, you'll find this article. I had an outdoor antenna range which could resolve the 0.05 dB of difference, a 20th of a dB, and I did experiments with putting antennas close together and putting chunks of metal in front of the antenna and find out what happens. And the main thing I found, let me drop this. As long as the foreign object being brought to you close to your antenna was not resonant on that frequency of your antenna, 95% of the time, it's not there. And as you do move them closer and closer together, the first thing that happens is the capacitive coupling from the radiator of the antenna in question, as it comes close to other pieces of metal, adds some extra capacitance to the tip of that radiator on your antenna and tunes it to a slightly lower frequency. If you're willing to readjust the length, you can bring it right back into resonance and full performance again. That's what the Fenco 6 and 2 antenna did, with 6-meter and 2-meter antenna elements on the same boom. So I would say in all cases there's never going to be any interaction. But if you think there's going to be interaction, you can do a measurement to find out real fast. Radiate a known number of watts into the 6-meter antenna and put some kind of a power sensing device, receiver, spectrum analyzer, or whatever, that's quantitative, on the 2-meter antenna, in my example, and find out how much energy is coupled into it. And in many cases, you're going to find out that they're 20 decibels isolated, if you know what I mean. You put 100 watts into the first antenna, and you're going to see less than a watt out of the other antenna. That's a 20 decibel difference, and you're going to find that in many cases. So when in doubt, you can make that measurement, if you care to confirm it. Back to you for a final on this one, Steve. And keep coming back with these questions. These are goodies. KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I think that about covers it. Definitely appreciate the info, everybody, and I'll come back with something new, I'm sure. Appreciate your time, guys. Thank you very much. KD2HUC, back to net.
Very fine, Steve. Greg was next, N2AIR, in Maspeth. And Greg, with call letters like that, you've got to be a pilot. But maybe it's just lucky. Go right ahead, Greg. N2AIR, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Did you forget me? I had a question on the last subject.
You said you had a question on a brand new subject, and I put you on the list. Let me go to Greg, and then I'll come back to you, Joe. N2AIR, go ahead, Greg.
Okay, Dick, this is N2AIR. And just recently somebody told me, who used to do work as a tour guide in New York City, he said in Soho, you would occasionally see next to certain addresses in Soho, AIR, but it stood for Artist in Residence. So that's a new twist to it. Anyway, I've got a question very, very related to the previous questions that were asked this evening.
We're ready for your question, Greg. Go right ahead. I wonder if Greg ran into a problem with the battery running down, or sometimes these modern rigs with the push buttons on it, you can by mistake go off to the wrong frequency. N2AIR, K2RIW. Right now you're number one on the runway, Greg. Okay, maybe Greg has had an interruption of his equipment while he's fixing that. Let's go over to Joe. W2RYY, with some further questions on the previous subject. You got it, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Good evening. And sorry about waking up the other day. In the case of a mobile installation, you can't bend the roof of your car down. Say theoretically, take the theoretical example, you're using a quarter wave antenna for 2 meters. Put that through a hole in the roof and put that on the roof of the car. You can't bend the roof down to make the a ground plane effect like you have a ground plane radials on a house mounted type of installation. So what happens in this case, the antenna, is it theoretically a little shorter or a little longer to bring up the impedance to 50 ohms? Back to you.
When it comes to bending down the radials of a VHF antenna up in the air, in order to give a better impedance match. You're trying to keep the antenna as simple as possible, add no other extra components to it or doodads, and get the right 50 ohm impedance, for instance, if you're using 50 ohm transmission line. However, if you go the very next step, there is nothing magic about forcing the antenna to be 50 ohms. There's at least two approaches to this one. Number one would be an antenna tuner, maybe a remotely controlled antenna tuner that a number of people have used on their mobile. But if the feed line is short enough and low enough in loss, the antenna tuner doesn't have to be remote. Another approach is an impedance matching device, usually an L network. One inductor, one capacitor, carefully chosen, can give you an impedance match to anything in the world. If you knew by way of your antenna analyzer, you know what the impedance of your antenna is, reactive component and or resistive component, and you go to the Berkeley program. Let me drop it. You Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, plus impedance match. You'll get this beautiful program written by Berkeley, the college in California. And Berkeley will ask you, what is the impedance of your signal source? You'll probably say 50 ohms and 0 ohms of reactance. What is the impedance of your load? It's your antenna. And you might say 31 ohms of resistance and 10 ohms of capacitor reactance. And then the third thing Berkeley will ask you is what frequency you're operating at. And you might say 3.75 megahertz. You plug those pieces of information into Berkeley and you press go. And in a fraction of 1 second, you get 16 solutions. In other words, they gave you 16 diagrams. An L network, upside down L network, a reverse L network, a pi network, a T network, an L pi. Choose the one that you like. All the values are there. And you wind that coil by using the Radio Amateur's Handbook. Chapter 2, I think it is, tells you how many turns is going to give you how many microhenries. And you put the right size capacitor, and now you do a perfect impedance match by way of an L network you put in there. That's the second approach. The third approach is even more sophisticated yet. Let me drop. And that is you use the Brown and Woodward curves. I'll explain what that means in a minute. And you use the article by K2LIW. You go to either of the websites, amateurradio.tangovictor, and you'll see some articles by K2LIW. Or you go to the other website. This is Mike number one and Mike number two. These two beautiful aiding websites to the TechNet. The second website is limartechnet.com. And you look at those articles by K2LIW. And there's an article in there about how to get a perfect impedance match to any dipole, whether it's part of a Yagi or it's a dipole or by itself. Well, your ground plane antenna on your automobile is half a dipole. And so you can use the exact same philosophy as to how to get a perfect impedance match. And here's the well-kept secret. I want you guys to keep this close to your chest. Don't tell anybody about this. The secret has been there in plain sight since 1945, when Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward spent a man year of their life measuring every possible diameter and every possible length of a ground plane antenna, which is a radiator on a great big sheet of metal. They measured the real impedance, the resistive component and the reactive component. They published it they published it in the IEEE Proceedings of 1945. Let me drop it. And arguably that is the most valuable piece of information that's in every one of the four issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Jasek and Johnson, and by Velasic. Those are the four editions. Chapter 4 in every one of those issues has the Brown and Woodward curve. When you study the Brown and Woodward curve, you'll come to an interesting conclusion. Let's assume you've got a piece of 27 ohm impedance transmission line, just to give you a ridiculous example. And you look at the Brown and Woodward curve, and you find out that if you make the radiator a little bit less than quarter wavelength, the resistive component will come down. By adjusting nothing but the length of the radiator of any dipole or monopole-like antenna, you can make the resistive component be as low as 1 ohm and as high as 1,500 ohms, inclusive, anywhere in between that you want. If I've got a piece of as I said, 27 ohm impedance cable or 331 ohm impedance cable transmission line. I can make a perfect impedance match, resistive component, by doing nothing but adjusting the length of the radiator. However, once you choose the right length of radiator so that your resistive component is at right where you want, Murphy's Law dictates that 99% of the time there's going to be a reactive component left over. Under normal circumstances, we'd lose a whole lot of sleep over that. Let me drop. Let's assume now, I'll take the second example. I've got a 300 ohm piece of coax cable, assume there is such a thing, and I've now want my antenna to be 300 ohms. That means I'm not going to make it a quarter wavelength long, I'm going to make it something closer to 5/8 wave long. As you make it longer than quarter wave, the impedance goes up from the normal 72 ohms if it's a dipole. And you make it shorter than a half wavelength if it's a dipole, or quarter wavelength if it's a monocle, and the impedance goes down. So you choose the right length. In my example, I want the impedance to go up 330 ohms in my crazy second example. That means I've made it longer. Because I've made it longer, then the resonant length, to get the resistive component right, now the antenna is inductive. The second curve of the Brown and Woodward curves will tell you exactly how many ohms of inductive reactance you've got because you made it too long. I now choose the right size capacitor to put right across the driven element of the antenna, and the reactance disappears. I've oversimplified that a little bit. If you were putting the capacitor in series, you would get rid of the reactance in one step. But putting a capacitor in series with a dipole mechanically is a little bit homely. To put the capacitor across the two feed points of the dipole is a hell of a lot more convenient. And you need a little bit of interaction between length and reactance to do that. So you've got to go back and forth a couple of times between adjusting the length and adjusting the size of the capacitor. And the capacitor itself can be nothing more than a piece of copper tape with a piece of paper tape in between, and you peel it in order to get the right capacitance, if you know what I mean. You're just trying to find out what amount of capacitance is required to do the tuning, and once you find the right value, then you go out and put a real capacitor in there. So by doing a very simple procedure, adjusting the length to get the right resistive component, putting in the right capacitor or inductor across the feed point, and now you've got a perfect antenna. You ask any normal antenna engineer, let me drop.
Repeater, timeout.
You ask any normal antenna engineer, ham radio operator, or whatever, what do you do to make the antenna 330 ohms? And they'll say, well, you got to make all these extra mechanical construction devices like a folded dipole or a triple folded dipole with different diameters of rods and whatever. They've got a whole bunch of solutions like that. Yes, they work. Yes, they're the tradition. Much too complicated. The Brown and Woodward curve has had this data in plain sight for, what's it now, 60-some-odd years, but just adjusting lengths and putting in one simple fixed capacitor to make your dipole slash monopole a perfect impedance match, whether it's on top of your car, whether it's in the middle of a Yagi antenna, whether it's part of the feed horn of a parabolic dish antenna, you have complete control of the impedance by doing the simple adjustment of length and putting in an extra capacitor or an inductor. One extra component and adjusting the length when you know what you're doing. That article that I put in those two different places on how to get a perfect impedance match to a dipole is the name of the article. But as you can tell, it's such a simple piece of information that has been hidden in plain sight for 60-some-odd years and people didn't realize what the hell they're looking at. That makes me say that chapter number 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, in my mind, has the most valuable piece of information in that whole 1,400-page book. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet. You've got it, Joe.
Well, the antennas I was talking about are pre-made antennas you really can't take apart or put capacitors across them out. It's a little hard to do that. But you sort of answered my question of what they apparently are doing. I'd have to cross-figure it out myself. Apparently, the length of the antenna to bring up the impedance to make it match within a certain frequency band. And then another question related to that, if you had that antenna tuned on a vehicle or to work within a certain frequency range, now you take that antenna and put it on a mag mount, what happens? Does the length have to change to bring it back into resonance or make it more resonant, or does that effect of a thing being not mechanically coupled to the car roof anymore, or the antenna cable, have a much, much smaller effect on it?
There were virtually two questions there, Joe, and I'm going to ask them, answer them in order. Your first response was, I've got this commercial-made antenna for my vehicle, and there's no way I can climb in there and add this extra capacitor.
Yes, there is.
Right at the connector at the input of that antenna. Instead of connecting your cable directly there, you connect it through a T-connector. By way of that T-connector, right at the base of your antenna, you've now got an extra thing coming off to one side by which you can hang a capacitor, you can hang a stub. By way of a piece of coaxial cable that's shorted or open, that's the right length, you can now emulate, simulate any value of capacitor inductor that you want in shunt by simply putting that T-connector right at the input connector of your antenna and then weatherproofing it. And you don't have to take the antenna apart, you're not disturbing its resale value or whatever, you're leaving it pristine when you're doing that. So for you to put a reactor on your antenna, and for you to electronically change the length of the antenna, if you want it to electronically be longer, you can easily make it electronically longer by putting a top hat capacitor on it. Hang some kind of a wire top hat, if you know what I mean, on the top of the whip, and you've now electronically made it longer. So without doing drastic things to the antenna, you've got all kinds of adjustment capabilities if you're crafty enough. And the Joe I know can definitely be crafty enough to do that. Let me drop it. The second part of your question is that if the antenna originally was designed to be hard mounted to the sheet metal of your car, where the bottom of the antenna is really grounded to the frame and sheet metal of that car, and you tune it a certain way, and now you make that antenna disconnected from the grounding of the car, and it's now a mag mount, and the average mag mount has a very thin piece of plastic in the bottom to make sure the magnet doesn't scrape the paint on the top of your metal of your car. So now you've added an extra series capacitor. On VHF, UHF frequencies, that extra capacitant of that thin sheet of plastic usually is a big enough capacitor, a small enough capacitor reactance, that it's only a small amount of series capacitor to ground, which gives you a little bit of raising of the frequency. And there's ways you can readjust for that. On HF frequencies, mag mount, I'll admit now that the frequency is so much lower, that same amount of capacitance is now going to have a hell of a lot more capacitor reactance, and now a lot more retuning is going to be required. And in the case of an HF antenna mag mount, because the whip is usually so darn big, let me drop it. You don't want the antenna to fall off the car by way of wind loading or hitting a tree. You're probably going to use a much bigger magnet, like that triple mount magnet, that triple magnet you get from M squared, for instance. And now by way of three great big magnets sticking to the top of your car with a thin sheet of plastic in between them, you now can make a hell of a lot more capacitance, if you know what I mean. And you're going to kill two birds with one stone. You're going to have enough magnetic holding power that the damn thing doesn't fall off every time you go more than 50 miles an hour and get wind loading. On top of that, you've now got a lot more area to build that capacitor. And lots of people think that if the antenna, it's a vertical ground-like antenna on the top of the sheet metal of your car, if it's not ground into that sheet metal, making infinitely good contact, lots and lots of people think that the antenna can't give top performance. Absolutely not true. The fact that you put another series capacitor between you and the rest of that ground plane is just another tuning element. And if you're smart enough, you can retune to get rid of that effect by the way you readjust that antenna, if you know what I mean. Yes, it's an extra step to the process, but I know you've got the technology to do that, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that takes care of that part of the question. Here's a comment on the other thing you said about the multiple antennas. The guy's talking about like putting them on pipes next to each other. I'll take a different example, take them in a little slightly different direction, and you said it didn't make much difference. In the case of a car or an automobile top on a, mid-sized SUV type of vehicle, I had the experience one time helping somebody many, many years ago, somebody, same guy we both know, and he had a mobile installation where he had all bands in his car on from VHF working up, like 6 meters, 10 meters, 6 meters, 2 meters, 220, 440, 1200 meg. What I found out, or experience, was the two biggest antennas had the most difference if they were, they worked the best if they were farther apart as far as affecting the tuning. And the other antennas made very little difference. You put like VHF next to 220, next to 440, next to 1200 meg. But the two longest antennas had to be physically as far apart as possible, otherwise they did affect each other's tuning. Back to you.